Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome to Confessions of a Debut Novelist with me, your host, Chloe Timms. This week, I'm talking to Alice Slater about her thriller, Death of a Bookseller. Alice spent 6 years working as a bookseller with Waterstones, and she's now a London-based writer, also a co-host of literary podcast What Page Are You On? She chairs literary events and is a freelance editor and reviewer. In this episode, we discuss how she created separate playlists, played movies in the background, and used different vocabulary lists to create the distinct narrative voices in her novel. Why, after years of tinkering, she was able to finish the novel in a month, and why she loves book talk. But first, before we get into that, here's Alice with an excerpt from Death of a Bookseller.
Laura Bunting. Her name was Garden Parties and Wimbledon and Royal Weddings. It was chintzy tea rooms, Blitz Spirit and bric-a-brac for sale in Bright Church Halls. It was coconut shies and bake sales and guess the weight of the fucking cake. Pale skin, blonde bob, hazel eyes. Curvy, around 5'4" in flats. A scatter of chocolate moles on her chest, neck and arms. A silver stud in her left nostril, a pinprick scar from a healed piercing on the right side of her lower lip. Her upper arms and calves were inked with faded cliched tattoos. An anchor, a mermaid, a rose in bloom. A pair of swallows in flight, one on each shoulder, swooping towards her heart. A posy of lavender on her inner wrist. Laura, with her vintage tea dresses, her berets, her crimson lipstick, hand-rolled cigarettes, rose oil perfume that lingered. Laura, with her poetry. Laura, with her tragedy. Oh, how the rest of the team just loved their precious Laura. There was nothing she wouldn't do, no section she couldn't wrangle. Business, a pleasure. History, easy. Even the dullest jobs were transformed into breezy tasks when Laura did them. She cleared trolleys, she priced up boxes of pocket money toys, she shelved the most obscure books. She turned the Sunday morning vacuuming into a quick, light-footed waltz around the shop floor, flipping off the Hoover to chat and laugh with booksellers as she passed. It seemed like she had something to say to everyone, some little in-joke or snippet of news that made her think of them. She slotted in so neatly, like she'd been away for a long time and the shop was pleased to have her back. We had a connection, although she was too arrogant to lean into it. With me, she was just curt nods and clipped words and pursed lips, a frank look of dislike plastered over her face. She shrugged off my attempts to bond, took no interest in our shared history. In fact, she spent most of our shifts together, looking straight through me, walking past the till without so much as a glance in my direction. By Christmas, Laura Bunting was gone. And it was my fault.
Hi, Alice. Welcome to the podcast. I'm really excited to have you on with me today to discuss your debut novel, Death of a Bookseller.
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
So can you start by giving us the pitch? What is Death of a Bookseller all about?
Okay, so Death of a Bookseller, she's my debut. And it introduces two booksellers, the best bookseller you could hope to work with and the worst. So Laura is new to this bookshop in Walthamstow. The shop is kind of struggling. She's been sent in to like help zhuzh it all up for Christmas. And she's immediately very popular. She fits right in. Everyone loves her. And then we have Roach. Roach is the absolute opposite of Laura. She's not a particularly good bookseller. She's not particularly fun to hang out with. And she is absolutely morbidly obsessed with true crime, which Laura finds very distasteful. And the action of the book kind of happens as these two characters meet. Roach desperately wants a friendship out of Laura, and Laura would rather be seen dead than hang out with Roach.
So where did the kind of first spark of inspiration start? Because if people don't know, you used to be a Waterstones bookseller. So did it start with a kind of bookselling element, or where did Where did the kind of first spark come from?
So I think I kind of had two different sparks that ended up aligning. So the book really started with Roach. I just had this idea for this character. I was thinking a lot about both the kind of face of book selling online, which is often a very particular type of person, more of a Laura type of person. I was thinking about like creating something unexpected within that world. So that's where Roach came from. And then the true crime element was also just simultaneously, I was reading a lot of true crime and I was starting to think a lot about true crime. And I began thinking about ethically how I felt about it. And I think fiction is such a good kind of machine for figuring out how we think about things and how we feel about them. So Roach, it felt like a natural pairing to kind of bring these two themes together.
Yeah, I would like you to talk to us a little bit more about both of your narrators, because I think one thing your book does exceptionally well is observational kind of descriptions of these characters. I mean, I think we can all look at Roach and Laura and see snippets of recognizable people, and like I've seen people on Twitter be like, oh no, I'm Laura, like they're really elements of them that you can really see in other people. So I was wondering how you went about creating their characters. Did it start with this kind of archetypal bookseller that you made kind of slightly exaggerated or really focused down on her details? Tell us about where Laura and Roach came from.
So I feel like my characterization like method is sort of like watercolor. So I'll start with these very broad, very pale strokes, which are maybe a little bit archetypal or maybe a little bit cliched. And then we'll slowly add more and more layers to kind of create a kind of more 3D person. So Laura really started very much through Roach's eyes. My original first draft was only Roach speaking. Laura didn't have a voice. So it was very easy to create like, what is the most annoying person you could imagine if from the perspective of this like surly goth, what would she hate? So no offense, Chloe, but I made her blonde, you know, I put her in like cutesy little matching outfits, just all this kind of the kind of things that I felt like this character would really like pick up on and kind of grow to dislike.
It's the pumpkin spice lattes, isn't it? That's what it is.
Yeah, 100%. Thinking as well about those, like, the cliches of, like, the I'm not like other girls character, you know? Like, Roach is a bit of a pick-me, although she would never think of herself as such. So that's kind of where Laura came from. And then developing her further, I started thinking, like, well, what would be unexpected for this character? Like, in an ideal world, she would probably like to see herself as, like, smoking Sobranis in Paris, but actually she's a bookseller, so she can't afford the really expensive cigarettes. She's going to be smoking rollies. Actually, she carries a lot of trauma. So she doesn't just have one classy little glass of champagne. She absolutely necks the whole bottle and ends up shit-faced. And then, yeah, in creating Roach, she came to me much more full, you know, like much more kind of as a whole person. But it was quite fun trying to develop her through Laura's eyes, like thinking what Laura would see, what Laura would pick up on, what Laura would kind of... how she would observe her. That was quite fun. And in fact, the other day I read a review, which was a very positive review, but they described Roach as really badly dressed. And as I was reading this review, I was literally wearing the kind of outfit that Roach would wear. So I think maybe there's like a bit of me in both characters as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, like, how much do you think, I mean, everyone always says like your debut, you get so much of you in it, but how much do you think is you in Laura or you in Roach? Hopefully not too much of either.
I mean, I feel like because they all exist in my head. So I think there's probably a fair amount of me in both of them. But hopefully I've managed to develop them sufficiently so that that's not recognizable.
So when you're kind of creating these characters, do you go down the route of like kind of character lists or Pinterest boards, or do you have a kind of... a kind of straightforward method, or is it more just you kind of like write to find out who they are?
Yeah, I write to find out who they are 100%. I feel like I actually really struggle with those, like you can find like questionnaires and things online to develop characters. I really struggle with them because I feel like when I am feeling the character out, the answers to those questions will feel kind of arbitrary. Whereas actually I think through developing them in scenes, like figuring out actually how would they react in this moment, and sometimes you get it wrong, and through editing you realize No, she actually wouldn't even be in this room, or she actually wouldn't even respond to that. I found that that's the best way for me to create characters that feel real. But that's quite a slow process as well, and it involves scrapping a huge amount of work. It involves lots of rewrites. I wish it wasn't how I did it, but alas, I'm stuck with it.
That's your way, and it's worked, so it's fine.
Thank you.
Both your narrators are first person point of view, and you alternate between the two. I wondered what it was like to kind of create these very distinct voices. I know you said you started with purely Roach and then moved on to this dual narrative. Their voices are so different. Like Roach is very kind of spiky and cruel, like you say, when she's describing Laura, it's just so mean. But Laura is also kind of, she kind of glamorizes her life. She's like, to me, it reminds me of those very long, like Instagram captions of like, romanticizing everyday life, you know, you got the latte artwork, that kind of thing. Can you talk about how you created both of their voices and what the kind of process was like to write these two very distinct voices? I'm wondering whether you kind of wrote all Laura's sections at once, or did you kind of switch between the two depending on your mood? What was it like?
So I had started off just with Roach, and one of the reasons that I decided to bring Laura's voice into the book was that I couldn't quite bring myself to write purely negatively about book selling. Mm-hmm. Like, I loved book selling. I loved it so much. And I couldn't help, but I could feel that love was coming through in the text. And I actually then just raised it out certain sections, was like, this isn't Roach's voice, but I like it too much to get rid of it. So Laura's voice actually started from this very kind of warm, positive place. And that really informed how she speaks. I kept each voice separate. So I had a whole document just of Roach's sections, a whole document just Laura's. So when I was working with one character, I could really sink into their voice. I also have all kind of wacky ways of keeping myself in check. Like, I had separate playlists for each character. I always worry this sounds completely wild, but sometimes I'll have movies playing in the background while I'm writing. So for Roach, I'd often have horror movies on in the background and stuff that's very dark to keep me in that like weird headspace. And I also created a whole vocab list for Roach. So in one of my later stage edits, I was like, right, I got this whole list of like really morbid words and just tried to fit in as many as possible just to really bring out this like super death focused energy. I think Laura's voice came a little bit more naturally to me. I didn't have to go to quite such lengths to differentiate her. And also, like, she's such a funny one because actually she's a deeply unhappy person. And so although she's all sunshine and lollipops, outwardly, inwardly, she's not. So the voice actually ended up pulling a little bit darker. Sometimes I had to kind of lift her up a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting you say about having it initially all through Roach's point of view, because I interviewed Heather Parry last year. Have you read her debut?
I love her, amazing,
isn't it? And she said initially the whole book was from the doctor's perspective. And then she had some feedback that was like, no, Heather, no, you just can't do that for the whole book, because actually, for the reader, although as a writer we might really enjoy stepping into this kind of dark like mindset and morbid mindset, and I'm sure you had kind of a fun time in certain ways writing Roach, there's an element that you have to think of the reader and have to think what's their reading experience going to be like if they have that the whole way through.
You know what though, the other thing that like empowered me to create Laura but also therefore take Roach to a darker place was reading Boy Parts by Eliza Clark. So I'd already finished my first draft by the time I read that book. Or had I finished it? I was working on the book when I read that book, and I was worrying a lot about, is Roach too dark? Will I get loads of shit for her? Will, you know, the reader understand that like she is a fictional character and not an extension of my political worldview? And I was worried. I was really worried. And then I read Boy Parts and was like, you know what, I can take her there. Like, if Eliza Clark can create Irina Sturgis, I can do Roach. I can do Roach justice. And yeah, by separating the kind of softer bits out, I could take her darker. But then yeah, Laura does then lift the whole book up and make it a little bit lighter.
Yeah, I mean, I understand why some readers really dislike the kind of dark characters and the very unlikable or whatever you want to call them. But I just think, like, really, like, there's so much more to fiction than just characters that are relatable or do things that we understand. Like, surely the best place to explore darkness and human nature is through fiction.
I completely agree. And I also just love characters. I love writing characters and I love reading characters that do things that are unexpected. You know, like, and that doesn't always have to be like murder, but I like to be surprised by characters. But I kind of like to be egging them on. I'm like, go on, how far are you going to go?
And certainly Roach goes to places that as a reader you're reading it thinking like, oh my god, she's going to get found out, or you know, she is seconds away from being discovered, or she's doing things that you're just like, this is insanely creepy. But at the same time, you are kind of almost excited to see how far she pushes it and also what the consequences will be. So yeah, I think, yeah, push your characters to dark places. It's always a fun place to go. I'd love to talk a little bit more about the kind of true crime element to the book. And you mentioned like your interest in reading. And I think we've all been there and watched, you know, plenty of true crime documentaries or listened to the podcast and stuff. And I know you're a fan of the book Savage Appetites by Rachel Monroe, which is a great book that explores like kind of the human relationship to true crime. And I was wondering kind of what was it about the kind of surge in popularity of true crime that made you want to write about it in this novel? And because Roach obviously loves it for the kind of the morbid fascination, she goes to like a podcast live show. Laura has a very personal traumatic response to true crime, but also a personal connection, but she writes poetry or includes true crime in her poetry. So what was it you were kind of hoping to say or explore about true crime in this book?
So I feel like it's definitely an exploration, not a thesis. I kind of now have sort of settled on how I feel, but the writing of the book was partly me kind of going on that intellectual journey and deciding how I feel about true crime as a genre. One of the kind of kickoff points for me was that I went with one of my best pals to see a live podcast recording of my favorite murder. I went to see my favorite murder with my best pal, and I wasn't a massive fan of the podcast, but you know, I love a good time. We got some wine, we were having fun, but I had this really strange experience where we were in the Hammersmith Apollo, so this massive venue, and the podcast hosts invited a member of the audience to come on stage and share their story. And this person got on stage and shared their story, which was a complete non-story. They walked down the same street that someone was then later murdered on. It was not their story. It was very strange. But she then was able to fill in the gaps and say, you know, that then this had happened to this person and the perpetrator was cornered by the police and he fell to his death. And this whole room, mostly of women, all applauded this. And I felt like I was standing at the gallows. It was such an unnerving experience. And you know, the conversation that we were having in this space had nothing to do with the justice system, it was very apolitical. And yet we were absolutely, you know, surrounded by people who were applauding this death. And I just, it gave me chills. I really didn't like it. And it really got me thinking about the responsibility that we all have to think about the nature of the media that we're consuming and whether or not that media is useful or putting anything, you know, potentially harmful out into the world. So I really started thinking about it. But then I also found that this train of thought very quickly just led to a point of, you know, believing that all true crime is exploitative, which I also don't feel is true. So then I read Savage Appetites by Rachel Monroe. By that point, I think I'd maybe written 30,000, 40,000 words of the book. And for those who've not read it, Rachel Monroe writes about true crime and women who are interested in it from four different perspectives. It's just such a fascinating book. And it was the first time that I'd really read something that was critically engaging with the genre without just fully dismissing it outright. So that's what kind of where it all came from. And, you know, by the time I finished writing the book, I had just consumed so much true crime that it was definitely doing me some damage. Like, I was getting increasingly paranoid. I would wake up in the night, be convinced there was someone in the flat. I felt increasingly vulnerable. and wondered if maybe I would be happier if I stopped reading that shit. And so far, I think I am. But, you know, I can't help but be a kind of morbid beast. So I'm sure if something new comes out that has that like literary bent or a personal bent, I will probably be sucked back in.
I wonder whether that kind of anxiety and tension of you experience this paranoia was almost helpful in a way for building the tension in your book, because you do have characters with that really, I mean, it's a very, there are points in the book where you have that really high intensity and characters wondering whether they're being followed or whether there's someone's in the house. I wonder whether that kind of mood was helpful in a way, because I know you said you've used music and film, and I'm not suggesting that people go and do like method acting versions of writing, but you know, I wonder whether it was actually helpful for you for writing your story.
Oh, it definitely was. It definitely was. I think I put all of that in the book. You know, Laura does experience, and not without cause, but she does experience a lot of paranoia about home invasion, about people being in her space, of being watched. And that all felt, it was all a very earnest emotional thing that I was going through. I definitely don't necessarily recommend it, but if you're experiencing it, you may as well use it.
That is true. Yeah. So apart from being this really grossing thriller, your novel deals with obviously book selling, and you've put in a lot of kind of Easter eggs and fun little experiences that I'm sure many booksellers will relate to. And I was wondering like how fun it was for you to be able to really embrace the kind of the nerdy side of the bookish world and all the details of book selling that are all these kind of like in jokes. And I was kind of wondering what that experience was like for you.
It was fun. It was very fun. I mean, I remember for quite a long time, I'd always quite liked the idea of writing a book based in a bookshop. And then some colleague, I can't even remember who said it to me, someone very casually said, oh, every bookseller wants to write a book about bookselling. Every bookseller thinks bookselling's interesting. And I remember thinking like, oh, fuck, is that true? Is that, am I doing that? Is it a real cliche? So I kind of shelved the idea, pun unintended, for absolutely ages, thinking like, oh, no, I don't want to be doing something cliched. I'll rethink. But of course, a bookshop, but for forcing together characters that would not interact in the real world, retail is a great place to put them, because you are absolutely trapped with that person. You have to interact with them. There is no way you can go. You cannot even leave the shop floor if it's just the two of you working. So it felt very natural, and I was like, fuck it, I'm going to indulge myself. I'm just going to do it. And then I had a lot of fun trying to figure out, you know, which secrets to share and what I should hold back, and thinking through like what's actually interesting to the reader and what's just indulgent. I really enjoyed it.
How good a judge do you think you are of kind of what is interesting to the reader in terms of like the book selling element? Because I think particularly if it's something that we as a writer are really interested in or obsessed by, it's hard to work out whether that is just something we like or whether the reader would like it as well.
Luckily, that is what my editor was very good at saying. So we're definitely sorry. We took some bits out where it was just like, actually, this is just too much. Like, we don't need to go into this much detail about like the life cycle of books or, you know, Christmas stock situations. Like, we don't need to do that. So I'm very thankful for that. Otherwise, it could have perhaps been a little bit tedious.
Well, it isn't, thankfully. I want to touch on your journey from your writing journey as a whole. And I know that you've spoken about your writing process on your podcast that you host with Bethany Rutter. If anyone doesn't know it, it's What Page Are You On? I wholeheartedly recommend that podcast. I will link the episode in the show notes, but I wonder whether you could just speak a little bit about your kind of writing process in general. What kind of writer you are? Are you a planner? Are you a early morning writer? Just give us a few of the details.
So I'm just chaos. And I know that sounds like very like, oh my God, I'm so random and quirky, but unfortunately it's a burden that I deal with. I'm not a planner. I really like to feel my way through my plots based on my characters and the vibe and, you know, whatever inspiration I happen to have found that week. I do a lot of writing on my phone, on my notes app. I do a lot of writing like on the fly. I love the idea of being an early morning writer, and I kind of am, like, on my days off. So I work as a copywriter 4 days a week for a marketing agency. So on those days, I'm just working. I will only write in the evenings. But on my days off, I'd be up at like 8 and get right on it and then work pretty solidly all day. Sometimes quite late into the night if I'm on deadline, like I am right now. Which I don't recommend it. I wish that I was methodical and slow. I wish that I was capable of writing books in chronological order. But alas, I've discovered that the best way to get the thing done is to stop fighting the grain of your own brain, like stop trying to go against the grain, and do whatever gets the word count up.
You tend to write scenes that come to you and that are most interesting at the time, rather than thinking, okay, today I've got to write a confrontation between Roach and Laura.
Most of my first draft, and yeah, I write quite short and I write based purely on my own pleasure. So a lot of my first draft was just whatever inspo I had. I love reaching. Have you ever heard the phrase flow state? You know, like that for me is like the nirvana of writing. And I find that I will only ever really feel that when I feel like super inspired. So a lot of maybe those scenes end up on the cutting room floor because the plot goes in a different direction, whatever. That maybe they'll get reused later on if the setting or concept works in something else. Otherwise, fuck them, doesn't matter. But then also, actually, you can't just write like that. You do have to write the connective tissue as well. And that's when I'll be a little bit more like, okay, you have to write the scene where these characters get introduced now. And often I'll find that I really hate it. I won't be happy with the writing. I'll keep sulking about it, keep wondering if I can just cut it. It will come in and out, in and out, in and out. And then eventually I'll just have to like send it all off as it is and see what my editor thinks.
And what do you do on the days that you're really, really struggling? Do you just kind of stop and give up, or do you persevere and kind of think, I've just got to get something down and then I can do something with it later?
Honestly, it depends on the time of day. If it's like 11 a.m., you just have to suck it up. Like, I don't get to have days off just because I can't be bothered to do it. If it's later in the day, I kind of think if I'm hating, particularly if I'm working with edits, if I'm hating the suggestions and feeling really dismissive of them, then I probably need to take a break and come back to it. If I'm actually hating the work or hating myself, then I will stop for the day because I probably just need a break.
So I wanted to speak as well about your career in the book world before you became an author, because you've done a lot of chairing events, interviewing other authors, you've worked as a bookseller, you've got your podcast, also you're very known for kind of reviewing books and chatting about books on your social media. I wondered whether you think that your kind of knowledge of the industry helped you become a better writer or gave you a better knowledge of the process and the industry to understand what it takes for a book to become a success?
Yeah, I mean, certainly I think it helps to know what you're getting into. I'm obsessed with this industry. I'm obsessed with books, but I also am obsessed with the nuts and bolts of how everything works. I'm just, you know, curious like that. And I do think it's been helpful. It's been really helpful to be approaching things like marketing meetings from a place of knowledge to kind of understand what is unusual or what's normal. That has been a massive help. In terms of like the success of the book, I guess we don't know yet because it's not out yet. So we can only hope that it's all going to go well, but you can never take these things for granted. But yeah, I mean, I said, I feel like for any aspiring author, any debut author, that would be my advice, is to find out as much as you possibly can about how the industry works, because it's not going to hurt, you know, it's not going to hurt.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And you're one of the people who've really embraced BookTok. I know you're a big fan of TikTok. And I know many writers or people who are hoping to get into the industry really worry about A, social media, but particularly at the moment, TikTok. And they worry that, you know, they have to be doing it and they, you know, they have to get involved. What's your experience of TikTok being like? And what would your advice be to anyone, particularly writers who are out there, interested actually in using the platform, people who like maybe aren't afraid and want to take that first step?
I mean, I feel like ultimately, if it's not something in your heart that you really want to do, then I don't think there's any value in forcing yourself to do it, because it's ultimately just going to be a big distraction from the actual work that you have to do. What you actually have to do is write your damn books and read other people's books, whether you're reading front list or back list. Like, those are your two most important jobs. However, if you are already into social media and you're interested in a new platform, I think TikTok is a really exciting space. It has a very different audience to both Twitter and Instagram. You don't have to be a creator on there to benefit from it as well. In fact, I would absolutely advise anyone interested in TikTok to just set up an account and be an observer. Find the good stuff. Don't be lazy and just watch the clickbait shit and think that that's what BookTok is. Like, you do have to put some work in to like find the creators who are saying something smart, who are creating content about your genre. You do have to do that work, but it's really rewarding. And, you know, as a result, I've met so many really exciting, interesting people who I would not have met on other platforms. So I think it's really worth doing. In terms of content creation, I'm not gonna lie, man, it's really hard. Like, I think the platform has changed the way that it works. So TikTok, it used to be a little bit easier to get your kind of videos out there and viewed by other users. It's now so much more difficult. The algorithm has just kind of eased back a little bit. So I think it's also about being consistent and not feeling as though low view counts are anything other than just the natural start of building up any new platform. I also think not overthinking it is probably golden advice. Like, you don't have to be creating really complicated videos with loads of different cuts and a voiceover music. You can just upload 7 seconds of a camera filming the sunset, a stack of books, whatever, and put text over the top. That's still a TikTok. You're already doing that on Instagram. You're probably already creating those sorts of posts on Twitter. You can just recycle that material and put it on TikTok. Nice and simple.
Yeah, and I also really agree with what you've said about not doing it if your heart's not in it, because I think it's really obvious when people aren't comfortable on social media and feel like they're doing it almost because they have to, or they're feeling forced to do it, and it just doesn't feel authentic. And I think that's probably not going to help. You know, if you're someone that just doesn't want to do it, I don't really think that it's not going to kill you to not be doing it. So I think it's probably better to stay away.
Yep, I agree. And also, like, at the end of the day with TikTok, as a writer, whether you're on there or not, hopefully your books will be on there anyway. Like, you don't have to be involved in that. Let the readers find your books and let them share their passion for it. You don't have to be involved.
Yeah, and it also takes away the temptation then to comment on people's reviews, particularly if they're negative. So
oh my god, I know, terrifying. Absolutely terrifying.
So Alice, can you tell us about how you came to get your agent and your book deal, Did you, I'm guessing, I mean, you've always written and you've written short stories and things. I'm guessing you've always wanted to be a published author.
Yep, man, it's been the dream like forever. I do have a slightly unusual like path into publication though. So, or maybe it's not that unusual, but
there are like hundreds of ways. And I always think it's helpful. And so it's kind of helpful and unhelpful to hear it, because it's probably frustrating for some people to hear different routes. But at the same time, I feel like it's slightly reassuring that you don't only have to do the querying and then hearing no's or hearing nothing. There are other ways to it. So yeah, share your story.
And also, I think, as my story will demonstrate, I think like the other things you're doing in the writing world could still be shuffling you closer to that goal, even if you think it's not. So basically, I got a couple of short stories published in like, I think the first one was 2018, and then maybe like one or two a year up to about 2020. And I just got really lucky that every single story that I published, I was sharing on Twitter and Instagram. And an editor saw one of my short stories, really liked it. They approached me for a IP project. So for those who don't know what that is, it's where an editor or a publishing house come up with an idea and then they hire a writer to write it. And I was kind of intrigued, the idea. I was under NDA, so I can't tell you what it was, but it was something that I was very interested in and thought it would be really fun. But I kind of said, can I do it under a pen name? And they were like, not really, like we would want your name in it. So I was like, okay, could I be honest that it's an IP project then? Because I hated the thought of like, you know, taking someone else's idea and presenting it as my own. And they were like, oh, that's really weird. Yeah, I suppose so, if you wanted to. So I was very on the fence. And then spoke to a friend of mine and was like, what do you think I should do? A friend who works in the industry. And she was like, I was like, I have this novel, I've got like 40,000 words written, so it's nowhere near finished. But then I have this thing which could be like just good, easy money. I'm a professional copywriter, so it would just be another job, you know, whatever. And she was like, speak to an agent. You should just contact agents with this dilemma and see what they think. So I did, and I approached maybe 10 agents, and one of my like first choice agents got back to me really quickly and was like, send me the rest of your book. And I was like, okay, this is all I've got. Obviously, I've been honest up front that it wasn't finished. And she was like, how quickly can you finish this? And I was like, oh God, I don't know. What do you reckon? And she was like, do you reckon you could finish it by January? And this was like early December. And I was like,
wow.
Yeah, I was like, fuck it, maybe, yeah. And we, you know, we were in lockdown, so it's not like I had anything else to do. So I signed with this agent, I finished the book, she sold it, and the rest is history.
Wow. So what happened with the IP project? Is that still kind of on the back burner, or was that?
No, it was just, I think the nature of these things, like it was a timely idea that needed to be produced very quickly. So we said, no, we've decided that we're going to focus on something else. And that was that. And I don't know if anything ever became of it. I don't know if they found another writer or not. Maybe it will appear one day.
And then you'll be spotting it going, I know the secret. So the first 40K that you'd written, how long had that taken? Because obviously the kind of finishing part of it happened within the space of a month or so. But what about that first 40K? How long had you been working on it?
Oh man, it took me, I mean, I think I first came up with Roach as a character in 2016. Whilst I was bookselling, so I left bookselling October 2017. I think I'd maybe got 20k done in that time, maybe less, maybe 10k. Left bookselling and then got to the 40k mark by December 2020. So it was very slow. But of course, by the time, there's nothing, nothing will get you writing quicker than that carrot on the stick of an agent being like, get this done and we can get this moving. But also, having spent all that time with those characters, I really knew them. And even though the book that I actually finished and that we sold to Hodder, to my editor, Beth, we ended up with a very different ending. Like, it's actually a very different book. But I'd spent enough time, I'd spent so long with those characters, I was able to produce the work at that kind of speed. I don't think I could do a novel from scratch that quickly.
Yeah, that's quite a feat. Was there a point where you thought this book is it, like this is the one, that's going to get me published? Because obviously you'd written short stories, and I imagine you kind of had other ideas for books as you were writing. Was there ever a point where you were like, this is the one, or did you not have that feeling?
I mean, I think I remember really clearly when I was on about, okay, so in my house, my husband's also a writer. And in my house, we always say that when you hit the first 10K, that's when you like have a stew going, you know, it's like an old like Arrested Development joke. Like then you've got your stew going once you hit 10K. And so I remember like having hit my stew point, and I told Bethany, my podcast co-host, Bethany Rutter, about this idea that I was working on. And every time over the next, like, however many years, I talked about or lamented, like, oh God, I'm still not where I want to be, blah, blah, blah. She would always kind of remind me, like, I really think this is the one that you need to finish, though. I really think that this is the one. So I always had that encouragement of at least getting to the end of the book. But truthfully, I think the only time I really felt, yes, this is going to be the one, is when we sold it. Then I was like, okay, now we know.
Now you can believe, yeah.
Yeah.
You mentioned having kind of some industry knowledge already, which has really helped you know kind of what's normal, what's not normal. But has there been anything since you got your book deal that's been surprising or challenging? And how have you kind of coped with the whole publication journey?
I don't think that I've had any surprises. I'm trying to think if there was anything that like really took me by surprise. Generally, no. I feel like I feel very lucky, I guess, that, you know, the Hodder team have just done something so exciting. I think that was the biggest surprise, is like seeing in the hands of others what this book would look like in the world. And, you know, like you do get asked a lot, like, do you have any ideas for the cover? Do you have any ideas for how you would market it? Like all very loose conversations just to like see what page, whether or not you're all on the same page. And I just couldn't, I had some ideas for the cover, but do you know what I mean? Like for me, it was just, it existed so deeply in my head, I couldn't really imagine it out in the world. So I think that was the biggest surprise, is just how much fun the campaign has been. Especially because the book is so dark, like there's a lot of stuff in there about like grief and trauma, and you know, it was, there's lots of real sadness in there. So it was really exciting to see the Hodder team really pull out the kind of dark humor and to do something really fun. Otherwise, I feel like, you know, it's not a completely serious book. There is a lot of like fun stuff in there as well, but I kind of forgot about that because I was too busy thinking about all the dead people and all the sadness. So yeah, I think that was my biggest personal surprise.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of darkness, but there's a lot of tongue-in-cheek stuff as well. Like I think if you're going in expecting relentless darkness, it's definitely not that. And I think there's, like you say, there's a lot of humor, but it's a lot of it is like quite black humor. So but that's fun. So I can see why they kind of wanted to focus on the fun side of it as well. So finally, are you able to tell us anything at all? I know you're kind of up against deadlines at the moment, but can you tell us anything about what you're working on next?
So the nature of my brain is that I change my mind quite a lot. So I don't dare give you any kind of plot summary, you know, any kind of elevator pitch, because fuck knows what will end up being published. But I can tell you it is set in my favorite city in the world. It's set in New Orleans.
You've just been to like on a research trip, haven't you, there?
Yes, I did. I went in January.
And how was that when you kind of were coming up with this book while you were there?
Oh, I mean, it was amazing. It's wild. Like I've been to New Orleans maybe, I think that was my sixth trip. One of my best friends lives out there. It's a city that I'm obsessed with. And I'd kind of, when I was deciding whether or not to go, it wasn't really an ideal time to go. We had a lot of stuff going on in our personal life, in me and my husband's, you know, life. So it wasn't an ideal time to travel, but I really knew that I needed to go. And I was so relieved I did, because obviously I hadn't been since before the pandemic. And like every city, it has just changed so much. And, you know, our memories are so unreliable. I think you can get a little bit bogged down and obsessed with getting things factually correct. And that actually sometimes you don't need to be so detailed when you're describing a place in fiction. But still, like just funny little details that I never would have picked up on or that I hadn't remembered. So yeah, it was a very useful trip. I'd love to try and go again before the final deadline, but I just don't think it's going to be possible. So, ooh, we'll see.
Well, who knows what it's going to be about, but I'm very excited to read it, nevertheless. And I'm sure it will change again when your editor works with you on it, because that is the nature of writing a book. But thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you so much for having me. I've had such a nice time.
That was Alice Slater talking about her thriller, Death of a Bookseller, which is out now and available to buy. And if you'd like to support this podcast, debut authors and independent bookshops, you can now shop in the Confessions of a Debut Novelist bookshop, hosted by bookshop.org, which I've linked down below in the show notes. If you fancy buying any of the books you've heard on this podcast, then the majority of them can be found in this bookshop. And if you can, I would really appreciate you supporting me, supporting the authors and independent bookshops by buying them through this online store. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Or if you've subscribed already, it'd be great if you could leave me a review. See you next time.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.